Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, we heard the NPR report there giving us a hint of what we're going to talk about in the first part of today's program, the judge's ruling in the Amendment 4 case. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. And later on, we're going to talk about the case of the scientist who was fired from the Florida COVID-19 data website. We're going to hear what she had to say in her defense last Friday night. First up today, a federal judge has ruled that the Florida law requiring felons to pay legal fees as part of their sentences before regaining the right to vote is unconstitutional for those who are unable to pay or unable to find out how much they owe. The 125-page ruling issued Sunday by federal judge Robert Hinkle in Tallahassee concerns the state law that implemented a 2016 ballot measure approved by voters to automatically restore the right to vote for felons who have completed their sentence. The Republican-led legislature later stipulated that fines and legal fees must be paid first as part of the sentence, in addition to serving any prison time. Judge Hinkle acknowledged he's unlikely to have the last word, expecting the administration of Republican Governor Ron DeSantis to appeal his decision. Howard Simon is the former director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida. He spent years organizing for Amendment 4 before retiring when the initiative passed with about 65% of Florida voters supporting it. This is what Howard Simon had to say about the judge's decision.
I'm not sure there would have been a civil rights movement in the 60s if the movement was not protected by federal judges. So my first thought was, oh my God, thank God that this case landed before a brilliant judge. The opinion of this judge might be as transformative as Amendment 4 was designed to be in the first place. This judge has just re-enfranchised several hundred thousand people.
Here in Hillsborough County, State Attorney Andrew Warren was a supporter of Amendment 4, and I asked him earlier today what he thought about the judge's decision. Andrew Warren, thank you for coming on WMNF. Good to have you here.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me.
How significant was Judge Hinkle's decision over the weekend?
It was huge. It was a good day for voting rights, for democracy, for American values, a really good day.
What does it mean for Hillsborough County? What's going to happen next in Hillsborough County under your watch at the state attorney's office?
Well, we are set to go forward with a process that we've been putting in place now for the past 6 months. And just by coincidence, the judge's ruling came out on the eve of us being ready to file the first set of documents to create the first docket to restore voting rights in Hillsborough. So we are expecting this week that the Public Defender's Office will be filing a motion to restore voting rights for 19 individuals who have completed all the terms of their sentence but for the fines and fees that they owe, which they're unable to afford. And the process that we've put in place was based and designed in large part on the preliminary injunction that Judge Hinkle granted last October. And that was really consistent with what he ended up deciding over the weekend. So it was nice to have sort of the affirmation from the federal court that the plan that we had put in place here in Hillsborough is legitimate, is the right approach to make sure that we are restoring the right to vote to people who otherwise couldn't afford to pay what they owe. Because at the end of the day, that's the issue. We don't want wealth-based discrimination. So people are still going to owe the fines and fees, but their inability to pay those fines and fees can't be a roadblock to voting.
How many people in Hillsborough County stand to have their voting rights restored under this judge's decision?
There are estimates of roughly 100,000 people in Hillsborough County. Whether everybody takes advantage of that opportunity, though, is certainly a different question. But at the end of the day, I think it's not about the total number of people. You know, this is something that by restoring voting rights, studies have shown people are less likely to offend. So it's a public safety issue. By restoring voting rights, you are expanding people's access to our democratic process. So it strengthens our democracy. And it would be great if all 100,000 people in Hillsborough County, or all 1.5 million across the state of Florida, took advantage of this allowance now. But the reality is, for the one person who decides to do it, it's really important for that person, for them to be able to vote, to feel like they are a full-fledged member of the community again, to make their voice heard, to reduce the chances of that person reoffending. That's where it matters, on a case-by-case basis.
You said a moment ago that people will still have to pay their fines and restitution down the road. This doesn't relieve them of that necessity. Yet there's a quote, and I'm just going to read from the WTSP-TV website, where Tampa attorney Richard Harrison, from a group called Floridians for a Sensible Voting Rights Policy, he says this: I don't think anybody intended when they voted for Amendment 4 to make it okay for a convicted felon to walk away from restitution. Under this judge's decision, is anybody relieved of having to pay restitution?
Absolutely not. And so this is one of the misunderstandings that opponents of Amendment 4 continue to raise. This ruling, same as our process in Hillsborough, does not delete that financial obligation. It doesn't wipe it out. And the Judge Hinkle did a really good job in comparing this to owing taxes. He said, think about if you go to register to vote and the supervisor of election says, have you paid all your taxes? Well, if you can, you can vote. But if you haven't yet, you can't vote. He called that idea morally repugnant. It doesn't mean that you don't owe that money to the government. You still owe the taxes. And we can even go a step further. Imagine if you had outstanding credit card debt and you weren't allowed to vote because you had that debt, and a court said, no, no, no. We don't condition the right to vote based on whether you owe somebody money or not. Now, it doesn't mean you don't owe the money anymore. You would still owe the credit card company debt. You still owe your taxes. And in this case, you still owe the fines and fees to the government. It's simply that if you are unable to pay, that inability to pay cannot be a bar to your voting. We do not discriminate based on wealth in this country when it comes to our fundamental rights, and voting is one of them.
It's widely assumed, but the governor has not said, that the governor, Governor DeSantis, will appeal this decision. Will it make much difference for the August and November election if the governor does decide to appeal?
I think it may. I mean, our hope is that opponents of Amendment 4 stop defending wealth-based discrimination. They see the writing on the wall. They see that a federal court has ruled against them twice now, that the appellate federal court has ruled against them, and they understand that it's just not right. Judge Hinkle wrote in his opinion that the state's position is a breathtaking attack, an exact quote, a breathtaking attack on the will of Florida's voters. That's pretty harsh language. And the hope is that the opponents realize, look, they've lost this battle, and let's figure out a process to implement Amendment 4 in a way that voters intended, in a way that doesn't discriminate against people based on wealth.
We're talking with Hillsborough State Attorney Andrew Warren, and this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Andrew, you talked about recidivism a moment ago. Are there studies that show that people who get their civil rights restored, such as voting rights, offend fewer times in the future?
There are. There are studies that show that, exactly as you said, Rob, that restoring people's rights makes them less likely to reoffend. And it's, when you think about it, it makes perfect sense. The better you integrate people back into the community, the more connected they feel and the less likely they are to reoffend. But it goes beyond just that public safety aspect of it. As I said, it is about public safety, but it's also about fairness. Florida was one of only three states that permanently disenfranchised felons. Florida accounted for 25% of all disenfranchised people across the country. 25% of all Americans who were not able to vote were in the state of Florida. That's crazy. And the reason why is because we have this horribly outdated system of denying the right to vote for people with simple felony offenses. I mean, you can have traffic offenses or a drug possession case from 30 years ago, and you're still not able to vote. That 47 states did it differently. It's about time Florida got on board with the rest of them.
I want to ask you about the orders to the stay-at-home orders that Hillsborough County has implemented, and that practically every government around the country has. a local pastor, a pastor named Rodney Howard Brown, was arrested on misdemeanor charges for holding a church service a few weeks ago. I understand that those charges have been dropped. Why were the charges dropped?
The charges were dropped because the decision to arrest the pastor and others who were arrested for violations of the state home orders, compliance was the goal. That was the goal from the very beginning. The idea behind the enforcement was to make sure that people understood that they were supposed to stay at home and avoid these crowds for responsible social distancing. And our county's leaders were clear when they enacted the order. Prosecution was intended as a last resort. So in the case of the pastor, we succeeded. He said he was not going to comply with the order. He was going to have 500 people in the church. He was going to do whatever he wanted. He stopped. After he was arrested, he had a change of heart. Let's say that he saw the wisdom. And he decided, you know what, I'm not going to risk the health of my parishioners. I'm going to comply with the order. He's been complying ever since. So prosecuting him wouldn't have been a waste of taxpayer dollars. It wouldn't have made our community safer. All it would have done was been excessive punishment for someone who is now in compliance. As I said before, compliance has been our North Star in guiding how we prosecute these cases. So we had maybe a dozen arrests or so for people violating these orders, and where the violation, where someone had come into compliance and the violation wasn't connected with a violent crime, we didn't prosecute them because we achieved what we wanted to, which was to have people start complying with the orders.
Because there are a lot of people out there, not a lot, but there is a group of people, I think it's fair to say, thinking that the whole country has turned into a police state because of orders like the emergency orders that were passed in Hillsborough County about social separation and about limiting some businesses from being open, churches from being open. When you hear people say that we've turned into a police state, what do you say back?
Well, I think it just comes down to a lack of understanding. Our freedom and liberty is a fundamental principle, of course, if not the preeminent principle in our country. But there are times where we're allowed to infringe on those liberties for the sake of the entire public. And the simple example is, we have free speech, right? But you can't shout fire in a crowded movie theater. So that's an infringement on free speech, but it's one that we recognize as legitimate. And by the same token, our Supreme Court has recognized for decades now that when there's an emergency in place that calls for some restrictions, whether it's a curfew or, a stay-at-home order now, that as long as it's reasonably tied to what the problem is, that it's constitutional. And so there have been places across the country where, courts have said, yeah, you guys went overboard in doing this, but I don't think we had that in Hillsborough County. I think we had a pretty narrowly tailored restriction saying we want people at home during a certain time. There were allowances made for a host of activities, from going to the grocery store to going to work to going to the doctor's office to going to the vet. It was basically we didn't want people socializing in a way that jeopardized the health of the entire community. And that's what we did, and I applaud the county for their efforts to do that, and hopefully it worked.
And you say a small number of people, maybe a dozen or so people, have been charged with this misdemeanor of somehow violating the emergency orders, and not all are being prosecuted because some people now are complying.
Correct. I mean, we had, it was about a dozen cases over that first month, and our office was leaning towards prosecution when it clearly promotes public safety, but consistent with how we've tried to handle cases like this from the beginning, low-level, nonviolent offenses. We don't want to punish people, prosecute people for the sake of punishment. We want to solve the problem. And when somebody learned their lesson by having been arrested in terms of staying at home, then we've solved the problem. So it was a good thing that the pastor changed his mind on this and that he stopped holding church in a way that, jeopardized not only his parishioners, but everybody else in the community that they would have come into contact with it, Publix and Target and Walmart.
Well, Andrew Warren, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming on WMNF and telling us, giving us a further perspective on Judge Hinkle's decision.
Absolutely. We'd remind people again, you know, when it comes to the coronavirus, people should act like they have it and thank God if they don't.
Good advice. All right. Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great morning.
That's Hillsborough State Attorney Andrew Warren discussing the federal judge's ruling over the weekend that the Florida law requiring felons to pay legal fees as part of their sentences before regaining the right to vote is unconstitutional for those who have an inability to pay or they're unable to find out how much they owe in the first place. And the state attorney's office passed along these statistics from the Brennan Center. We heard most of these during Andrew Warren's answers. Hillsborough may have as many as 116,000 residents eligible to have their voting rights restored. Amendment 4 was passed overwhelmingly with 65% of support from voters in 2018. Before Amendment 4 passed, Florida was only one of three states to permanently strip voting rights from anyone convicted of a felony. Florida is estimated to have nearly 1.7 million people unable to vote due to a felony conviction. Of those 1.7 million people, that represents more than 10% of Florida's voting age population. And it accounts for 27% of all people unable to vote in the USA. 27% of all people unable to vote in the USA because of felony conviction live right here in Florida. Those statistics from the Brennan Center for Justice. If you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, you can call us up at 813-239-9663, or you can email us here in the studio at dj@wmnf.org. Let's take a call from somebody who's been holding for a while. David is in Port Richey. David, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I just want to say it's so good to hear WMNF back at full force. And I want to thank you and all the staffers, and especially Randy, you know, for doing what you did for the last, you know, few months. It held the station together.
Yeah, Randy certainly worked hard. All right. Thanks, David. Thank you for that.
And I'd like to say about the voters, act right. The Voters Act, you know, I didn't vote for that. And I felt if you did the crime, you should do the time. And if your voting rights are stripped, so be it. But, you know, the people that might get their rights restored, do they have to enter into some sort of contract or some sort of payment system so they continue to make their payments? Or are those payments totally, like, forgiven?
Well, that was a point that Andrew made in the interview. They're not forgiven at all. The defendant is still under court jurisdiction, and whatever agreement for restitution or fines that was made at sentencing, that still exists. And, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I could get a lawyer back on, but I think Warren was very clear. He makes a distinction between paying restitution and having your voting rights restored. And the judge says, don't conflate the two. The process of getting restitution paid continues. That doesn't stop. But in the meantime, the person does have limited civil rights restored. One of those is voting rights, or the only civil right restored is voting rights.
Don't you think that should apply to driver's licenses as well? I mean, suppose you're unable to pay your fines for driver's licenses, and you're unable to drive, and you can't go to work. It's like a catch-22. Don't you think in the same, I mean, I'd be interested to see what other people say, but don't you think that people should be able to drive as long as they enter into some sort of a contract, like child support especially? You know, a lot of people can't pay child support. But, you know, if you enter into some sort of a contract where you make payments, at least that would enable a person to get to work.
Yeah, you know, I think most judges, when they hear those cases, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm not in the courtroom at all, they say to the defendant, look, you can go to work, but that's all you can do. It's kind of way off the topic, Dave, because I don't have an expert here. I'm not an expert. You're not an expert. Maybe we ought to talk about driving rights and get somebody in here who knows something about it.
Because a person that, you know, makes a driving offense and does losing their drive, that's a lot different than a felon, you know? I mean, a felon is somebody who's really done something pretty darn bad to be called a felon.
Yeah. All right.
I don't know any felons.
All right. Well, maybe I'll do a whole show. What's that?
Is Mark going to be on?
There's a process, and I'm not going to read it on the air, but there is a process day by day for new programmers, or for our regular programmers, rather, to come back on the air. And I think it's the third week in June that public affairs programmers are supposed to come back on the air. But I don't have that piece of paper in front of me. It is a rather lengthy edict from our station manager, and I don't want to get it wrong. Let's take a few more phone calls, and then I want to talk about the scientist who was fired from the state of Florida. Let's go to Dave in Tampa. Dave, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Hey, good morning, Rob. I'm still unclear. Are felons now, are they able to register and vote, or is there an injunction against that?
I think felons who go through a process, and part of the process is set up by the state attorney in Hillsborough County. I think if they go through that process, that they're able to sign up and register to vote.
So if DeSantis appeals this, they're still able to go ahead. Is that correct?
Yeah. The process of appeal is usually a lengthy one, and at least for right now, felons or ex-felons, people that have served their sentence, they should begin the process. If they want to vote, they should call up. I would call up the supervisor of elections office and say, hey, I'd like to sign up to vote. What do I need to do?
And, yeah, that just hasn't been clear to me, and it's critical. I think Mr. Warren is naive to think or to even hope that you're going to have anybody and the Republican Party at this point who's going to want to, run up the white flag and sit down and sing kumbaya. They're all about power and money, and they're going to do everything they can to prevent this from happening. So if people who have been convicted of felonies can't vote now because of an injunction, that should be made clear, and we ought to be calling our state representatives and senators and telling them to back off. It's time to stop.
All right. Well, Dave, I hope you do that. I hope you take your own advice. Thanks, Dave. Good to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Antonio in Tampa. Antonio, thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
I want to say, so what you guys are saying is, so after you serve your time, they still saying you owe restitution and you're not able to vote because of that? They were trying to do that?
Well, it all depends on the case. I mean, if the case involved making restitution, you still owe restitution, but you can regain your right to vote, though, despite the fact that you owe restitution.
Yeah, because my understanding was when you go to prison, you pay your debt to society with the time that you were incarcerated. So, I mean, so if they want to make somebody pay back restitution, I think they should make the prison companies pay that back after all off the profit they made.
Yeah, Antonio, I hope you're not assuming that people owe money just because they went to prison. Is that the point you're trying to make?
No, that's what I think. That's what I'm understanding.
No.
They're saying, well, you went to prison, you owe restitution.
No. Antonio, no. You owe restitution if, let's say, that during the commission of a crime, you stole something from somebody worth a large amount of money, and you haven't paid it back, and that person was victimized by your crime in which you stole money. And at the end of the court trial, if you're found guilty and the judge says, look, you got to pay the person back and I'm going to sentence you to, a year and a half. That's when you have to pay restitution. Only when the judge at the end of a trial, and you're convicted of stealing something or some other crime that causes maybe property damage. But it's not everybody who goes to prison has to pay restitution.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. So that's when they try to say about the court costs or something. They try to throw in the court costs and all that in there as well.
Well, I think that is part of it, and I think you got to work that out. But that doesn't mean that you can't vote. You can still vote.
Okay, just wanted to clear that up.
All right, Antonio, thanks a lot. I don't think that it says to a defendant, you're home free. You probably still have to work it out. But the fact that you're indigent and don't have money doesn't prevent you from voting. Let's go to Rob in Thanota, Sassa. Rob, you're on M&F. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. To me, the whole idea of denying people the right to vote based on being incarcerated makes no sense overall.
Well, that's a relic of the Civil War. Yeah. That's a relic of the Confederacy. That's a relic of trying to keep people down who are African-American.
Right. And I would ask this. We fought the revolution over the concept, partially, of taxation without representation. Now, let's say you got arrested for something and you go in for 2 years. All right, so I guess the idea is your civil liberties are suspended for that time. Now, the thing is, if you own a house in Florida, you still have to pay your taxes on the house. If you have, like, say, you have a portfolio, you know, and you're making money on the stock market, you know, you would have to pay taxes on that money, or capital gains tax on that. So,
I think that's why people passed Amendment 4 a couple of years ago, is that that's what they said. Look, just because you're in prison doesn't mean that your right to vote should be permanently squashed. So I think that's why 65% of Florida voters said that a few years ago and voted for Amendment 4. They agree with you.
Let me ask you this. Aren't there, this is not a federal thing at all. This is all state by state. Is that correct?
It is state by state.
Now, aren't there some states where inmates are actually allowed to vote? Is that right?
I haven't seen that. There may be. I did look this up a few months ago when we were talking about this, and I know that there are several countries around the world that the U.S. always points to as good countries, and citizens are allowed to the right to vote. One of them is, or rather, prisoners are allowed the right to vote. Israel is one of those countries.
Well, that's to me. I just think the two they don't have anything to do with one another, and that it's just purely punitive.
Yeah, I think that's why people voted for Amendment 4. Yeah. All right, Rob. Thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. 813-239-9663. I want to talk about this scientist in just a moment, but every line is lit practically. Let's go to Kevin in Bradenton. Kevin, you're on M&F. What's up?
Hey, Rob. I just got to make one quick comment. The thing about the felon, I'm not a lawyer, but I have been arrested for marijuana, which is a nonviolent offense. And I was lucky enough not to be caught with too much. But if I had been, like say if I had had an ounce rather than a couple of joints, I would have been a felon. And I wouldn't have been able to vote if I didn't have the money to pay my court costs, correct? My point is, when people say felon and they associate all kinds of bad things with that, is it not true that there's a lot of felons that are nonviolent criminals that are there for drug offenses?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Absolutely.
But that's my problem with people kind of lumping everybody that did a felon into this category of being these...
Everybody's looking on the dark side of this. Florida voters are hip to that, and a few years ago, they overwhelmingly passed Amendment 4. I mean,
right.
You know, so not everybody buys into this theory that all felons are murderers or rapists, and certainly there are some, and they're not part of this. They weren't included under Amendment 4. Voters, I mean, I kind of look at the bright side and say Florida voters are pretty smart, and they realize that not everybody's in prison for some horrible crime. Sometimes they're just peddling marijuana.
That's true. And the only thing I got to say, though, is that, that is an example of Florida voters being smart, but I'm not going to list the examples of them not being smart, Rick Scott, et cetera. But I still think that it's sad that some people do equate felons and forget that some people are just nonviolent.
Yeah, I think sometimes that does happen. But I think in this case, Florida voters showed that they see through the stereotypes. One of our callers, Rob, asked where can people vote who are in prison? I'm just reading this from Newsweek from a few months ago. It says at least 16 democratic countries allow felons to vote even while they are in prison. These countries include Canada, Croatia, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Finland, Ireland, Latvia, Lithuania, Macedonia, Serbia, Slovenia, Spain, South Africa, Sweden, Switzerland, and Ukraine. So at least 16 democratic countries allow felons to vote even while they're in prison. even some countries that many people in Washington in the current administration look up to. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. And Lisa writes this, inmates can vote in Maine and Vermont. Lisa Marzilli sent me that. Her source is themarshallproject.org. So, Lisa, thanks. Good to hear from you. 813-239-9663. And we'll take maybe one or two more phone calls. Let's go to Holly in Tampa. Holly, thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Hi. I think it's very encouraging that the this petition in the right to vote for felons is has been reviewed and up for restoring rights. But I would also like to mention, I think, at a deeper level behind all of the consternation or the refusal to acknowledge those rights is that Florida remains one of seven states that still has debtor prison. And that, you know, includes Texas, that is Alabama, that is Arkansas, it is Florida, it is Georgia, and rounding it out is California. And we, one of seven states, we have a special, you know, place within our, Florida's always special for something. But I think that it's noteworthy that we are one of seven states that does continue to have debtor prison.
And Holly, how do you, how just so, I mean, I believe you, but how do you know this?
How do I know this? Well, I know it actually because I researched the laws about debtor prison. And that actually came about because I was listening to NPR years ago. Before the pandemic, before, you know, all of these other social issues, which have always been there, but now they're really bubbling to the surface. And I couldn't believe that people were in prison or in jail because they simply could not pay a court fine or, you know, the fees. I didn't think that was possible. So I started researching. I thought debtor prisons had been eliminated, you know, falsely, I believed, that we did not have such laws on the books. But in fact, we do, and Florida is one of seven states that continue to do that. And I believe that until, and the stigma, and to the gentleman's point before, there is stigma being a felon. I understand that, but a DUI will get you a felony conviction. And this also speaks to the discouraging, the absolute conflict or not conflict in our country, but I believe that the schisms are beginning to become these huge, you know, cracks in our foundation, our culture, the Constitution, where we are punishing the poor and continue. And that's how you don't get out of that cycle. And this pandemic, I don't think there's anything positive about it, but if there could be something positive out of it, I would think that now these issues finally have to be addressed. And to the heart of this, I think Florida needs to start crafting legislation that forbids anyone from being in a prison or jail because they simply can't pay a court cost or a fine for an offense that is, as I said, a nonviolent offense.
But all right. Well, Holly, I'll have to look into that. I believe you, and it's a topic I've not done, and I'll pay attention to it. Thank you.
Okay, and you know what? I'll leave you with this. I just pulled it up to make sure that I was right in what I'm telling you, but the most recent article I pulled was Truth Out. And I hope you do look at it because I think it's a topic that really drives at the heart of what you're talking about.
All right, Holly, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Bye.
All right. Good to hear from you. I want to play this because it's so interesting. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663, and our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Last week, we talked a little bit about the case of Rebecca Jones. She was the computer whiz who has a PhD in geography, but her real claim to fame is statistics. She had helped develop the COVID-19 website that is run by the Florida Department of Health. And that website has been lauded nationally as a great website. Well, Rebecca Jones, who was instrumental, she says that she was the one who actually put it up, who was instrumental in that website, and that website is widely cited. If you watch TV today here in Florida, you see the COVID-19 website in the background, usually as they try to illustrate their stories about the pandemic. Well, she got in trouble. She talked to Florida Today a few days ago, and she said that while she was fired for refusing to manually change data to favor Governor Ron DeSantis's reopening plan. Then subsequently, and we played some of the sound last week, Governor DeSantis and others attacked Jones's credibility. They attacked her character. They attacked her credentials. They downplayed her importance to the Department of Health. Jones was given the chance to resign by 5 p.m. last Thursday or face dismissal. She did not resign by that deadline. And then the next day, late in the evening, she went on CNN. So let's listen to this interview that Rebecca Jones gave to Chris Cuomo on Cuomo's primetime show on CNN. And you can see this on the CNN website. And this is what she had to say about her firing.
And let's name no names. Do me two favors. One, let's keep it out of the weeds because this data stuff gets dense really fast. And let's name no names because I have not had the chance to get responses from all the different players. All right. So to be fair.
Understood.
Okay. So the simple question is, what exactly were you asked to do that was so unusual and improper and, in your opinion, wrong?
Well, the first time I was asked to do something improper was in April. And when I brought basically what the results of whether or not each county could open to superiors, they essentially told me they did not like the results.
How
so?
What does that mean they didn't like? Help us understand.
The results didn't match the report for reopening that had already been written, basically saying that a lot of rural counties, because of a wide range of reasons, didn't meet the criteria that the state had outlined in order to qualify for reopening, whereas some more populated counties did meet that criteria. And I was told that specifically, and this is a quote, we can't tell Jackson and Franklin County that they can't reopen, but Broward and Miami-Dade can.
Okay. So let's stop there for a second, Rebecca, just so we give it to people in chunks, okay?
Okay.
All right. So what they say is, no. This was just about dates and different ways of organizing data. We do this all the time. It wasn't about hiding anything because everything came out. And in fact, it's still available now. So if the data is available, we never wanted it deleted or hidden. So we did nothing improper. Why are they wrong?
They're lying because asking me to delete data and hide information and make it publicly inaccessible was a bad decision. It was a wrong decision that I stated very clearly in several email communications that I still have. I did not agree with. I actually referred to it as being the wrong call. We had really built our reputation in Florida and made my dashboard famous across the whole country and even the world because we're transparent and we were honest about what our data was and what it meant. If there was an issue with the data integrity, they would have never put it back. But they did as soon as they started to get calls saying, why is it the same day that the press asked you about this information, do you decide to delete it and pull all the information down from the website?
So wait, so they're making the opposite argument, just to make it clear. They're saying we never deleted it. So that's how we were able to put it back. That's why it's still there. They disagree with you with why it was put back. They say it wasn't because the media was asking. They were just organizing the data differently, and they have 100 very deep reasons that I don't get. And neither will anybody else. But they say it was never deleted, so we never asked you to delete it, or you just decided not to delete it because it was never deleted, so we're okay.
It was absolutely deleted, and it's public record that it was deleted. The data did go down. It broke all of the links across our Department of Emergency Management website, our own Department of Health website, as soon as it went down. I have the email records ordering me to take it down. As I said, I replied, this is the wrong call. And then immediately right after that it was down and that was it. About an hour later, I was told to put some of the data back, but not all of it. And the next day, I was told to return all of the data in the exact same form that it had been published the day before that and for weeks before that period of time.
So when you say deleted, it was something you were still able to recall. And that winds up being one of the points of discrepancy. So now their second point of pushback is, by the way, we had nothing to hide because we're doing great. We're ahead of Georgia. We're ahead of Texas. Our numbers are out there. DeSantis was late to the game in terms of opening back up. So we weren't trying to force anything. We were late in reopening, and we're doing better than everybody else, and the numbers show it. So why would we hide them?
We are doing well. We are doing much better than a lot of other states, and certainly a lot better than people expected Florida to do, considering that we had spring break open and, you know, as you said, we're late to the game. And that is something that I've defended and championed for the governor and our health department the entire time I was working on this project, was how well we were doing. But now it's impossible to know how reliable that data is because they changed the way the data is calculated. They changed how they record the data and how they publish it. And data continues to go missing from the website when the dashboard now crashes all the time.
How do you know? So explain this to us as non-statistician, non-quantitative people. One, how can you explain that they are doing data in the wrong way, which is a deceptive way? How can you prove that they do it for bad faith and not just a good faith dispute about how to process the data?
So when I offered good faith statistical methods to account for rural counties, because a yes or no, this county meets this criteria is a little strict. I offered to do a couple of different statistical methods. You know, my background is in climatology. Averaging things out with variability to distinguish trends is kind of our, you know, bread and butter. And they said no. They said they were going to exempt counties with a population of less than 75,000 entirely from the criteria that would be applied to every other county. And then they decided to change the way that they calculated the number of positive or the percent positive of people and changed it to new cases over total tests per day.
Why does that matter?
Which is also deceptive.
So why is it deceptive?
So let's say I give you 100 apples, right? And 50 are rotten. And I ask you what percent are rotten? You'd say 50%. If I then tell you that 30 were rotten yesterday, 10 were rotten 2 days before that, 5 are almost completely rotten, but not quite, and I've cut the other 50 non-rotten apples into hundreds of tiny little pieces, what percent of the apples are rotten? It's still 50%.
Yeah, it's still 50%, but it's about
50. Right. Yeah. You've just made it extremely complicated and convoluted. So what we used to do for percent positivity, which was one of the benchmarks that each county had to meet in order to qualify to reopen, it had to be below 10% and decreasing for 2 weeks. So normally when people think of a percent, they think the number of positive people divided by the number of people tested. That seems honest and fair. They changed it to number of new cases per day over the number of negative tests per day. Mm-hmm. So if you decide you want to get tested 5 times today, you count 5 times towards a negative if those are all your results.
And that's
whereas
the way it
if
still
I
is?
Go positive, I count once.
Is that still true?
Yes.
All right, last
thing. That is still how they're referring to positivity.
Here's what they say. Forget about the numbers. We're doing great on the numbers. We don't care what she says. But I'll tell you what we do care about. Her. She didn't like how this was going, and she handled it badly. Here's the response from the Florida Department of Health. Rebecca Jones exhibited a repeated course of insubordination during her time with the department, including her unilateral decisions to modify the department's COVID-19 dashboard without input or approval from the epidemiological team or her supervisors. The blatant disrespect for the professionals who were working around the clock to provide important information for the COVID-19 website was harmful to the team. Having someone disruptive can't be tolerated during this public pandemic led the department to determine that it was best to terminate her employment. In other words, you got a two'd problem. You didn't like what they told you, so you handled it badly. Do you accept the criticism?
Somewhat, yes. If refusing to mislead the public during a health crisis is insubordination, then I will wear that badge with honor.
The way they wanted to do it and the way you wanted to do it aren't equal in the eyes of experts?
No. None of the methodology that I was being asked to apply, which really wasn't based on any statistically sound methodology at all, was not science. they were asking me to manually go in and basically type yes or no, this county meets it, with any real risk assessment as to whether or not that county should. There may be plenty of rural counties that were perfectly safe to reopen that we will now never know because the numbers were manipulated.
What's your next move?
Well, as you've heard, I'm out of the job. So I'd like to get back to doing what I love.
Would you want to go back there?
Helping people. No, not unless there's a change in leadership, no.
Well, that was the woman who was fired as a health data scientist from the Florida Department of Health. Her name is Rebecca Jones, and there she was appearing on the primetime CNN program with Chris Cuomo, and she was answering charge that she was, among other things, insubordinate. You heard her answer there. She has told the Florida Today newspaper and CNN that a senior official in the state of Florida asked for the entire COVID-19 dashboard to be taken offline because it provided too much data. She said she was asked to massage the data for specific rural counties, so those rural counties met the statistical criteria to reopen. And she says the state has changed the way that COVID-19 testing positivity rates are calculated to better suit the governor's arguments for reopening the state. And Jones said that in late April, her superiors told her to make changes to data in specific rural counties to make them look like they were eligible to reopen. After she refused, they simply moved the goalposts so they could, she said. All right, so that's a little bit of the Rebecca Jones story. We haven't heard the end of it. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. So we've been talking about a lot of things in the news. Diala writes this, so we have a provision in the justice system for those who cannot pay. It's called community service, and it is not used enough, writes Diallo. And then David writes this, Ms. Jones was on CNN. I have to check out that interview later. Florida definitely has the stuff hitting the fan now, writes David. And then Greg writes this, DeSantis' response to Jones' firing seems to be straight out of Trump's playbook, writes Greg. And then Les writes this, regarding felons' right to vote, kudos to the judge for doing what's right and supporting the will of Florida voters. Up next should be and will be expunging arrest records for the purchase and or possession of illegal drugs for personal or private use. The yes-no questions on employment applications are damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you answer truthfully, your application goes in the garbage. If you lie and the employer finds out, you lose your job. This is a career burner and denies our nation of much-needed talent. I should know I was burned, writes Les in an email. You can send your email into the studio here. The address is dj@wmnf.org. And let's go to Doug in Clearwater. Hi, Doug. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Rob. Okay. I don't really even know how to get here, but I know you're not a psychologist, and you probably didn't stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night, but why is it that people at the top cannot figure out a way to work together? You know, really?
Who are you talking about? Which people at the top?
Any of them. I started at Trump. Last week, Pompeo was brought to the news saying that he was using personal aides to do, or political aides to do his personal work. You got DeSantis. I mean, we can't work together. I mean,
well, it sounds like Trump and Pompeo and Pence are all working together. They're on the same page.
I don't know. It's a rhetorical question. I'm sorry to bring it up, but I tell you what, if I was the Secretary of State, I would have enough sense not to do what they do. And look, I'm voting for Biden. So I have no idea why Trump does what he does. And you cover this clearly. So that's all I had. Thank you.
All right, Doug. Thanks a lot. Thank you, Doug. 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. There are new coronavirus statistics that just came out. More than 52,000 people have been infected with the novel coronavirus in the state of Florida, according to the latest figures on the health department's website. That is, if we can trust those figures. Florida recorded 424 new cases Tuesday, bringing the state's total to 52,170. More than 9,482 people have been hospitalized with the virus. The death toll is now 2,259 people. That's up 7 from yesterday. And I'm reading from the News Channel 8 website for that. Well, if you want to comment about any of this, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Doug's question, I don't know how to answer that. I think the Trump administration and Governor DeSantis, I think all Republicans are pretty much working together and in line. And I think they have a unified goal, and that is to support the president. And I think they're at the top. You know, if you go to the top in Tallahassee or if you go to the top in Washington, the people in power are Republicans. And the Republicans have chosen to back the president, I think, 100%. You almost never, it's very rare to hear a Republican dissent from the president, at least somebody who's in elected office. And maybe I could be wrong about that, but, so to Doug's question, the people at the top are working very closely together. I think the question is this the direction you want the country to go? Do you think the president is handling the COVID-19 crisis the right way? Do you think the president is being honest with the American people? Is he cleaning up what he used to call the swamp in Washington? Are we seeing people act more ethically in Washington, D.C.? Are we seeing people not use the government to their personal advantage in Washington? What do you think? We've for years and years on this station and many other media outlets have complained about the revolving door in Washington, where somebody goes into Congress and then comes out to be a lobbyist and using their connections makes a lot of money as a lobbyist. And then sometimes they go back in to work for a different agency. Maybe they go into work for the Pentagon and then come out again and become a lobbyist. Make oodles of money and have incredible influence on what goes on in Washington, D.C. But, you know, the question, I don't think Doug is asking the right question. The question is this the direction that you want the country to go? And I think, you know, we've had lots of callers who call up at almost every opportunity and say they love the president. They think he's doing a great job. And then we know that our country has the worst outbreak of the COVID-19 of any industrialized nation. We know that it doesn't seem to be contained. The number of cases in Florida, at least, continues to go up. If you look at the latest chart, it looks like we're having somewhat of a rebound, just a slight one. But if you looked at the number of cases, new cases, it looks like there's a rebound going on. So I don't know if Doug is asking the right question. I mean, if he wants bipartisanship, if that was Doug's question, then do you think that there is a way for there to be a bipartisan solution, a way out? The president used the word skank when he mentioned former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton the other day when he tweeted out a comment about Hillary Clinton. And I thought, nowhere in our lifetime have we ever heard a president use such base language. And so how easy is it for the two parties to work together, especially when the Republicans seem to, berate every Democrat. President Trump, famous for calling people names, people that he disagrees with names. Interesting that in the Republican Party, he called Mitt Romney and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and all sorts of other people names, or had degrading terms for them or degrading statements about their family. And then we see those folks working with President Trump. Somehow They were abused by President Trump, and they've accepted him. But I don't know if you can expect Democrats to be abused by President Trump and then accept it. I don't know if that's something that any self-respecting human being would do. If you've been abused by the president, could you go to work for him and help make the situation better? Well, if you want to comment about this show, you can call us up at 813-239-9663 and record your comment about this show on extension 115. I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. We've got the latest news coming up next. From NPR, this is 88.5 FM, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lake.